feel like I want to baptize someone here. Thank you, Larry. I love Larry. I like his dogs a lot better. But, you know, he is a dear friend, man, and he's introduced me to some wonderful people out here. But anyway, my name is Kip Collins, and I'm an alcoholic. And I ain't had a drink all day long. I ain't hurt nobody. I didn't hurt myself. I went to work all week and I paid my way. Every night coming home, driving up the road, all my neighbors waved at me every night with all five fingers. And I pulled in the driveway and every single night my kids come running out and they said, "Daddy's home." That might not impress you, but I had no idea people could live like that, you know? That is just a novel concept. I love the state of Georgia, except your pollen during the spring, you know. But I'm a native Californian. Anything below 60 degrees or above 80 degrees, I leave. I like it 72 degrees at about, you know, 30% humidity year-round. That's where I live. And that's civilized. That's the way you're supposed to live, you know. I'm going to share a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today with you. My father's Irish, and he's Sioux. And he was raised on a Cheyenne reservation in South Dakota. And my mother's Irish and Choctaw from Oklahoma. And my daddy liked to drink. And my mother loved to, and still does, loves to fight. And, you know, it wasn't, you'd be waiting for the old man to get home, and it'd be getting later and later, and we had hard wooden floors, and my mom would start marching, you know. And the faster she marched, the better show it was going to be, you know. And after a while, you'd hear that pickup truck bouncing off the curbs coming up the hill, you know, and if you looked out the window right about that time, you'd see all the neighbors grabbing a lawn chair and trying to get a good seat outside. You know, Daddy'd fly in that driveway. My mom would fly out that front door with a butcher knife. You know, she'd go for the driver's door. He'd bail out the passenger side door, and they'd be chasing each other around the house, and all the neighbors would be cheering, you know. And that was just Monday night, you know. The reason I tell you that, you know, I hear a lot of people say, "Well, I come from an alcoholic, you know, and I drank cold." My father was a prime example to me about alcohol. I wanted nothing to do with it, man. I saw what alcohol did to him. I saw what it did to us, you know. It made us the laughing stock of the neighborhood, you know. I was afraid to go out of the house. I mean, it was humiliating. And he embarrassed me, and I didn't want nothing to do with alcohol. I was never going to be like him, you know, so I can't blame him. I blame the San Diego Unified School District. In the early 60s, they had this great idea that they're going to bring in all the young folks in there. We're going to tell us about that stuff we don't talk about in A&A, you know, and they showed us this movie, and then they got up, these two guys, and got up and told us about going to prison and all this stuff with it, and I'm listening, you know, and they flipped the lights back on and dismissed us, and I hit my best friend Balto in the ribs. I said, "Balto, can you get some of that?" And he said, "Yeah, my daddy smokes that stuff." I said, "Well, cool." And so the next day I said, "You get it?" He goes, "Yeah, meet me after school." So we hooked up. I said, "So what do we do?" He says, "Well, we got to go boost some wine." I go, "How come?" He says, "I don't know." He says, "But my daddy always drinks wine with us. You know, we didn't want to make no mistakes." And we went down to this little place, and we stole a short dog. I got one of the sweet red port. That was my first drink, and that was my last. But he got a bottle of Muscatel, and we went down this little canyon where nobody could see us. You know, and he fired up that little cigarette, and he started taking a hit off of it. He gave me some. I started coughing. I didn't like it at all. But I looked at this stuff. And I pulled off that fancy screw cap. And I took a pull on it, you know, and that stuff hit my belly and it jumped right out of me and landed on my shoes. But I ain't no quitter, man. I ain't no quitter. I took another pull on her, you know, and it did that yo-yo thing with, you know, you got to kind of squeeze your nose and just force it back down, you know. And then I take another pull and it'd go down nice and smooth. And pretty soon, man, I finished that half pint and I was just going, whoa. And I said, Balto, you're going to drink that? He goes, nah, man, that stuff is horrible. And I said, mine? He said, knock yourself out. He says, you want some more of this? I said, no. And I took his and I drank his. And that was my very first spiritual awakening. But I don't say that to be funny. I'm telling you straight up. That was my very first spiritual awakening. I have no idea what alcohol did for y'all. Alcohol was the most magic thing that had ever happened to me in my life at that moment. I was raised in a neighborhood. It was all first-generation Hispanic. And nobody spoke English. Everybody had a dark brown skin. They had dark brown hair and dark brown eyes. My cousins lived with me. And my cousins are Indian. You know, they got dark brown hair, dark brown skin, dark brown eyes. And me and my brother Bill, we were born real Irish towheads, man. I had white hair, real white, blue eyes, and freckles. I knew I was different, you know. When I walk out of that house, the Mexicans wanted to beat my ass. And I walked in that house, and them Indians wanted to beat my ass, you know. And I grew up in absolute terror. I lived in a very, very violent neighborhood. There was lots of violence in my house. There was violence all around me as long as I can remember. And fear had been so ingrained into me, absolute terror, that it was actually part of me. And that day, I remember it crystal clear, man, because I leaned back and I looked up at the sky. And I knew something was different. And I suddenly realized I wasn't afraid of anything. You know, I felt like a whole human being for the first time in my whole life. You know, when I was 12 years old, I knew all about the first three steps before I ever met any of you folks. When I was 12 years old, I knew that I was powerless over this world. And I knew my life was unmanageable. And I drank this magic elixir, and I came to believe that there was a power greater than all of you. You know? And I immediately, with no reservation, turned my will and life over to it, and I never looked back. You know, it was a couple years later, I hit a teacher and knocked him out, and they expelled me from the San Diego Unified School District. It was a misunderstanding, actually. And I got home, and, you know, they had called my mom. And I tell you a little bit about my mom. I love her to death. I take care of her. My mother has Alzheimer's, and I take care of her today. But, man, in her time, she was about the meanest woman I've ever known in my life. You got to respect her. I mean, one time I saw her stab my daddy three different times. And one time the next door neighbor was yelling at me about something, and she snuck up behind him and knocked him cold with a shovel, you know. When I say you got to respect a woman like that, that's exactly what I mean. You got to respect a woman like that, you know. My mama plays no games. And I'm walking up the road, and she's looking at me. So you got kicked out of school, huh? I said, yep. And she holds up this little bag of green vegetable matter. She goes, what's this stuff? I said, probably just what you think it is. And she said, yeah. She said, get out of my house. You're done here. You know, I was 13. And I'd been waiting for her to tell me that since I was 5. And I went over a little place. I'm in Carlsbad, California. I'm talking to my buddy. I said, you know, he says, well, what are you going to do? I said, I don't know. And he opened up the newspaper. He says, check this out. This is about 1964. He says, all these young people are going up to San Francisco, and all they do is get up, get high, and listen to music and make love. I love listening to music. When I was 13, 14, on up to 50, you know, music was on my mind 24/7, and I share it a very general way about my experience up there. I was the worst hippie that ever got to San Francisco. You know, I'm a fighter. They were pacifist. You know, if they want to say something to me, I'd knock them out, you know. And I didn't fit in with those folks, you know. And I didn't fit in. And the only thing I've always been grateful for, you know, is that I'm not allergic to penicillin, you know, because that music damn near killed me up there. And some other music lovers out there tonight, huh? I found out what my true calling is. I'm a capitalist pig. I saw opportunity. I saw business opportunities that had never been presented to me before. It's, all my friends come from Mexico, you know, and they want this product. Everything, it comes from Mexico. They almost give it away down there. And I saw what they were paying for it, and I called my buddy, lifelong friend, Balto. I said, Balto, and I told him what was going on. He goes, man, that's unbelievable. I said, I'm not kidding you. And he said, well, come on down. And we started a little business, and, you know, and I don't like to talk about that stuff in AA meetings, but I only got one story, and I ain't going to change it to make y'all comfortable. So for you guys that are thoroughbreds, it'll just give you an opportunity to grow. And everything went real well for a long, long time until I turned 16 years old, and I was arrested down there with 200 kilos of this stuff. And I was sentenced to 25 years in prison, a La Mesa federal prison in Mexico. And, you know, and it sounds kind of scary. You know, I weighed about 90 pounds. You know, I had real long blonde hair, and I was a cute little thing. Like I'm walking up that prison, I saw them fellas looking at me, and I'm going, oh, boy, there's going to be an opportunity to grow. A little bit nervous at first, but, you know, then I signed, some guys came up and grabbed me, and they said, I'm Balto's uncle. Come with me, you know. And I found out that, you know, Balto was related to half the people in that prison, you know. And it was like old home week, man. It was family. And they took me in. I'd been making them people a lot of money. They didn't want nothing to happen to me, you know. And I was there for a couple of years, almost 2 years. And you know, Mexico is just a real civilized state. I love that country. You know, it works on the principle of mordida. You know, it just means, that's Spanish for a little bite. And that just means if you can afford it, you know, you can do anything you want. You know, I like a country that works like that, you know, and we, you know, they said, you know, you're worth more up there. And I got my education down there in criminology. And one day they just said, okay, go home. And when you get home, call this guy. And they opened the door and gave me a ride back up to the border. And I went across the border and continued doing on what I was doing. And about 6 months later, I got busted again up in California for on my 18th birthday at 5:30 in the morning for 27 felonies. And I should have paid closer attention to those guys. But I was living with this gal, and she was pregnant, and I was really excited about that baby. And they took and they locked me up, me and five other guys, and took us all down at the same time. And I sat in that old San Diego County jail for a year and a half fighting that case. I wouldn't cop to nothing. I don't make no plea, dog. I make you prove anything about me. You know, I don't make no deals with nobody. And these guys finally pled out and made a deal. They had let me and this other dude go, these guys, and they each got 12 years. And they let me go. And I got out of there, and I went to go try to go find that woman and find out about the baby, because nobody had written me, nobody had called me, and no one accept my calls. And I wanted to find out, and I went to the family, and they ran me off, and they said, you've done enough damage to our family. Stay away from us. And I respected their wishes. But I walked around for years with a big hole in my gut about that, you know. Right after that, I ran into this little girl. She had a lot of money. Family did. She was 15 years old. And anybody here besides Ray ever gone to jail for just being stupid in public? No one? Come on! You lying sons. Well, California, this company called Roar came out with this stuff, and I was always, you know, very experimental, and I tried this stuff, and man, I'd just do the stupidest things right in front of God and everybody. Nothing criminal, just stupid. And they'd lock me up, you know. And every time they would arrest me, I went to jail 3 times in 1 week. I've done it twice in one night before. And this little girl, I'd no sooner get to my bunk, you know, and they'd say, roll up. Someone's bailed you out. And I'd get down there, and that little girl would be sitting down there, and she'd bailed me out of jail. And the last time she did it, I looked, and I said, how come you keep bailing me out of jail? And she looked at me with those big brown eyes. She goes, well, what else do you want me to do? I married her. I like a woman that thinks like that, you know? I like a woman who won't go to bed until I'm out of jail. You know, and she can't testify against me, you know, so me and Kathy, God bless her, man, she was the greatest crime partner I've ever had in my life. And me and her went, you know, I went to prison again about 6 months after we got married. I did a little year stretch, and I got out, and I had this real unreasonable parole officer, and he wanted me to get a job, you know, and I don't do that kind of stuff. And, you know, I got my case transferred up to a little town in Oregon, and I got up there, and I went to the parole office, and this guy with long hair and a scraggly little beard, man, he's got a flower shirt on, you know, and I said, hi. He says, hi, I'm Dale. I'm your parole officer. And I went, really? And he goes, yeah, man. He says, just be cool and check in with me every once in a while. I said, okay. I never saw him again, you know. And one day I got, you know, while I was up there, you know, something real magic happened because Kathy got pregnant. And, you know, when I was a little kid, I'd hear men talk about what they wanted to be when they grew up. And it this and that, you know. And I started thinking in my heart of hearts, I wouldn't say it out loud. But as long as I've been alive, the only thing I ever wanted to be was a father. I wanted to have kids more than anything in this world. I can remember that as long as I wanted. I wanted to have a son. I wanted to have a daughter. I wanted to have the respect of my neighbors. I wanted to have a woman that loved me. And I wanted that so bad. And you know, I made this decision when I found out she was pregnant, then I'm going to turn my life around and I'm going to change things. And I'm going to get out of this fast lane and I'm going to get me a job and I'm going to start doing it by the book. And I did. And I got a job working out in the woods logging, and I fell in love with that kind of work. And, you know, and one day we went out to this hospital, and she went in one room, and after a bit, I'm sitting out on this bench. They come out, and they bring this little baby boy, and they put this little boy in my arms. And, oh, Lord, my heart absolutely exploded in my chest when that child touched my hands, and I looked at him. I don't have the vocabulary to tell you, man. You know, I'd heard about love and all that stuff. I didn't put much truck in it, you know, but I had never, ever dreamed how powerful, that total, absolute, unconditional love that I felt for that child. And it bowled me over, man. It was just so powerful. And I looked at this boy, man, and I promised him with all my heart. I said, you know, you are never going to have to be afraid of nothing. I will protect you all of your life. You're going to be my pal. You're never going without. And I meant it with everything I had. You know, and I worked up there for about another year, and my life was real good. I didn't drink. I didn't use nothing, man. I went to work. I worked hard, and I got real big and strong, and I joined a church up there, and I was living a good life. And we came back down to California. I got offered a better job down here, and I went back down to California, and she got pregnant again, and I went to this hospital, and I sat out in this room, and they come out, and they bring this little girl, and they put her in my arms. And the same thing happened. My heart exploded in my chest. Man, I fell head over heels in love. You know, I tell you something. I'm an alcoholic, and I think real, real fast. I've always had to, and they put that little girl in my arms, and I fell in love. And I'm realizing this is a female child. And someday someone's going to marry her. And I'm thinking, where are we going to have the wedding? What are the conditions? You know, I'll be sitting in an A&A meeting, and one of you pretty gals will walk in. We'll fall in love, get married, have a couple of kids. You'll cheat on me with that old timer over there. You know what I'm talking about. And I'll hate your guts. And you ain't even got to your seat yet, you know? And my mind works fast. And they finally took the baby. I said, we need to weigh this child, you know, and I gave it to her. But, you know, I gave her the same talk. I said, you know what, man, you're my sunshine. You're my baby girl. I'll protect you and you'll have everything. And I meant it with everything I had. And I'll tell you something, man, for the next 5 years, that's exactly what I did. I came back down to California. I realized, you know, I needed to make some money. I went off. I pulled off a real big scam. And I made a whole big old pile of money. And then I stopped. I bought a big place down there with a creek running through it. And we dammed it up, made a fishing hole for the kids. And my brother's always with me. My brother Bill, he's only 11 months. Anything I tell you about, he was right beside me. And my life was wonderful for a long, long time. I had the choice of, I was always reluctant to drink during those years, because every once in a while I would drink, but it was always real unpredictable what would happen, you know, and I didn't like that. It scared me. So, you know, I really wanted to square away. I didn't want to be like my dad. It scared me. And everything changed. On September 6th of 1976, my school was getting ready to start. My wife and daughter had gone to go get some school clothes shopping, and it was real hot that day. And me and my son were out in the yard playing frisbee, and a fellow friend of mine came down. He brought something down to smoke, and we smoked it, you know. And I didn't drink a lot, but I really liked my beer. And I didn't have no beer. He left, and I just got that cotton mouth, and I wanted a nice cold beer more than anything in the world. No one was around except me and my son, and she had the car. And I told my son, I said, you know, wait right here. I'm going to run up to the store on the bike, and I'll be right back. And I went up there to go get a six-pack, and I come back down the road. I'm coming down the house, and in front of my house, the police are there and the fire department. All the neighbors are running towards my house, and I didn't know what had happened, you know. But I got up there, and I found out my son had chased me out of the driveway, and he'd been run over by a pickup truck, you know. And I got to find that little boy, the sunshine of my life. He was laying there, and I could see his brains, and there was ribs protruding through his chest. And both legs were broken, compound fractures. And a piece of me died. A piece of me died. And I got to that hospital with that little boy, you know. I ain't never been to church, you know. My parents didn't do that kind of stuff. And I didn't know nothing about God. But I cried out to this God at this hospital to please give me my son back. You know, I meant it with everything. If you give me my son back, I'll do anything. I'll do anything if you give me my son back. And I sat in that hospital with him for almost 9 months. And my son survived. His body did. But I got back a child that never got past the age of about 4, and he couldn't hear and he couldn't talk. And he had a lot of psychological, emotional, and physical problems all of his life. You know, in the middle of all that, my brother had gotten sick, Bill, and he came down with a disease called schizophrenia, and my family had him committed. And my brother called me from that hospital after he'd been there for a little while. He said, Kip, get me out of here. Do whatever you got to do. Get me out of here. And I said, are you okay? He says, yeah, just get me out of here, man. And that's the way me and my brother roll, man. And, you know, whatever, we back each other no matter what. And I went against the family, the doctor, my family, everyone, and I got him back out of there, and I brought him back home. And, you know, I needed to make some money, and I put a deal together real quick. And I told my brother, I said, Bill, I said, I got to go out of town. I'm going to be gone for about 3 days. Watch Jana. And he goes, man, you better not go. I said, what's wrong? He says, I don't know. I'm coming apart, man. And I looked at him, man, and he was shaking, and he was crying. I'd never seen my brother cry. I said, you okay? He said, no, I'm not okay. And I said, well, listen, man, I got to go. You know the deal. You know the deal. I got no choice. I'm already committed to this. I got to go. And I handed him a handful of money. You know, money's been fixing things all my life. And I gave him some money. I said, you know, just hang tight, man. I'm going to be gone for 3 days. When I get back, me and you will fix this, you know, just like always. And, And I looked at, I got in this cab, and I looked at my brother, and he was holding my little girl's hand, and he was crying. I'd never seen it, never seen that before. And I went to New York City, and I did this, and everything got sideways back there. And, you know, instead of 3 days, I was gone for 3 weeks. And I came back, and my daughter was waiting for me in the driveway. And I said, "Where's Bill? Where's your uncle at?" And she goes, "I haven't seen him since right after you left, Dad." And he had a little mobile home right across the creek from my place, and we went over there, and I knew before. But I opened that door, and my brother's head rolled out of that trailer, and it was just a big pile of maggots laying in the doorway. And, you know, 3 days after I'd left, my brother blew his head off, and his head hit my foot. My psyche completely snapped. It was like a branch breaking. I don't tell you this for any other reason than just to drive home one very pertinent point that gets missed at a lot of meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's in chapter 5. They read it at every meeting you go to. But it says in there very clearly, it says, there are those amongst us who got here with grave and emotional mental disorders. And that's who I am. I'll tell you this from my heart to yours, that I thank God that I am an alcoholic. Alcohol does something to me that it doesn't do to other people. Alcohol immediately erases the guilt. It immediately stops those pictures that are burned right on the very front of my brain. It stops the screaming going on in my head. And it allows me to live one day at a time reasonably comfortable. When I first came to A&A and y'all read those promises, I thought you were talking about liquor. Read those promises again, because that's what alcohol does for me. Every one of those promises come true every time I take a drink. You know, things started disappearing, man, because, you know, I can't stop drinking. I ain't got no choice no more. I stepped across that line. And the more I drank, the more I wanted. And it was like trying to put fire out with the gasoline, you know. My wife, I'm not taking care of any business. My wife's in much pain as I am. But, you know, I'm so self-centered, I can't look at her, man. It's all about me. That was my son. It was my brother. You know, and I'm just wallowing this guilt and this pain. And there was another fellow, he was paying more attention to her, and she left with him. And I don't blame her a bit, you know. And she left me with just me and my little girl. My son's in this special hospital. And my little girl was crying. And she's going, "What am I going to do?" And I said, She goes, "Daddy," says, "what's going on? What's going on?" She goes, "Everybody's dying. Everybody's leaving. You're acting crazy. What's going to happen to me?" And I said, "Baby," I said, I pulled her up on my lap. I said, "Honey," I said, "you know, we just hit a bump in the road." I said, "I've never needed anybody in my life. All I need is you. And I'm going to catch my breath in just a little bit here. And everything's going to be okay. I'm going to take care of everything. I ain't going to let nothing happen to you. Don't worry." And I got her all calmed down, and I put her in bed and got her to sleep. And I come out, and there was a fella knocking on my door, and he walked in, and he sent my life in a complete different direction. I doubt if any of you guys have ever heard this. I was at a nice restaurant, this man, I was looking at their wine list, they didn't have any. Had that stuff that had, I don't know, I guess they couldn't afford the stuff with a screw cap, it had corks or something in it, I don't know, kind of weird. California, we call it Mad Dog 2020. Mad Dog 2020 is an event drink. I drank this Mad Dog 2020, and the next thing I know, this lady is saying, she's looking at me very perturbed. She has a uniform on, and she's saying, "Sir, you have to get off the airplane." I was in my living room the last time I looked, you know, and I opened my eyes. I'm looking around. I'm on this big old giant jet. It's completely empty. Except I look down, there's my little girl sound asleep. And she's cuddled up against my arm, and I'm looking at her, and I'm going, what? And she goes, you have to get off the plane, sir. I said, where am I? She said, you're in Fort Lauderdale. I said, I don't like Fort Lauderdale. She goes, I don't know nothing about it. You got to get off the plane, sir. And so I haven't got a clue. But, you know, you don't want to look stupid, you know. So I wake up my daughter. She's 5 years old. She probably knows what's going on, you know. And I wake her up. I said, Jenna Marie, we're here. I'm waiting for her to give me some information, you know. And she looks out the window and she says, oh, goody. That's all she said, you know. So, you know, I'm trying to be cool. And, I checked my pockets. I found out I had plenty of money on me. So I just, you know, said, well, let's go. I walked off just like I knew what I was doing. And I walked into the lobby, looked around, didn't want to raise any suspicion. And I called a cab. I said, take me to a nice hotel and stop at a liquor store on the way. I need to figure out what's happened here. And my next conscious thought, I came to and I was butt naked, hog-tied, and 4-point restraints on this gurney. And just for a second, I thought I might have missed something really cool, you know? More music, you know, and and then I saw the color of the walls. It was this calming green, and it had, the windows had bars on it. That's never a good sign. I found out what the alleged charge was, but allegedly here's what happened, I think. I was drinking tequila. That was a drink of my choice back then, and I met this young couple from Florida that were partying in this hotel, and they were drinking Jack, and they had this white enhancer. I mean, and boy, you could drink with that stuff, you know, and we went through my liquor, we went through their liquor, and we were still thirsty. I said, have you guys ever heard of Mad Dog 2020? And I felt like a missionary, you know. They hadn't, you know, so I went and got us a jug, and allegedly that about 3 o'clock in the morning, I was butt naked down in this hotel trying to introduce myself to this young lady. You know, I'm from Southern California. That ain't no big deal, believe me, you know. They're very uptight back here in the South, man, and they called the cops. I went completely berserk on the cops. They didn't know what the heck was wrong with me, man. They just knocked me out, tased me, you know, and pepper sprayed me and took me to county mental health. And they gave me some Thorazine, calmed me right down, and put me in restraints and took my clothes and everything else away. And so I come to, they explained to me what had happened, and I got to go talk to this doctor. And I told him, I said, you know, I've been through all this trauma here recently. It's a very sad story. And, this is a big mistake. I just got here yesterday. Here's my tickets. You know, I've got money. If you let me out of here, I give you my word, I will be out of your state before the sun sets. And the guy said, sounds like a deal to me, you know, and he let me go. And I don't know where my daughter is. I ain't got a clue. You know, they gave me my clothes, and I'm walking out trying to figure out a plan how I'm going to find my kid. And she comes running up the steps with this young couple, and she jumps in my arms. And I said, come on, baby, we're getting out of Florida. I told you this place sucks, you know. And I would love to tell you that that was it. That was the best it ever was. When they say this is a progressive disease, I'm here to tell you that that is the greatest understatement ever been given. For the next 3 years, me and that little girl, we traveled. We traveled on Greyhound buses. We hitchhiked. We lived in missions. Every once in a while, we'd run into one real sick pre-Al-Anon, go through her life like a tornado. And I was here in Georgia. I was in Alabama. I was in Mississippi. And every single place I lived, I left on a dead run at midnight with no forwarding address. I've been promising my little girl everywhere we went that I was going to get her back in school, you know, and that I was going to get a job, and we were going to do this, and I was going to do that, and I promised it to her, and she would believe me. And we'd get there, and the same thing would happen over and over and over. In the last place, I was running out of Georgia here, and I ran out of this young Christian man, real nice fella, and he was going to Oklahoma City. And he said, you know, when I got the ticket, that's as much money as I had headed west. And it ended in Oklahoma City. He says, you know, my family, we got a ranch outside, you know, and we could use a little help out there. And I'd really like to help you and your daughter get your life together. And if you're going to come out there, my daddy will give you a job. And we got a little place back there, a little house that you and your daughter could have. And, you know, and my sisters and my mama will get your daughter in school, and they'll get her some clothes, and my daddy will give you a job, and, you know, we'll really help you get your life back together, you know. And these were the nicest people in the world. And they brought us into their home and fed us, and my daughter just fell in love, man. She loved those people. We were there. They said, you can't drink here. And, man, you know, I didn't want to stay, but my daughter was begging me. She said, Daddy, please, please, these are nice people. And I said, all right. So I stayed, and I worked on that farm for those folks. And, you know, after a while, they gave me a paycheck, and I worked with this other guy. And they said, guy says, hey, I'm going into town to cash my check. You want to come with me? He says, I'll buy you a beer. Well, I ain't got to tell you what happened. You know what happened. I come rolling in that house at about midnight, you know. I got blood on my clothes, and it ain't mine. My little girl, she was sitting there waiting for me. And I walked in, and she looked up at me. And she knew, and she just got up. She grabbed a pillowcase, you know, and she started putting some clothes in it. And she grabbed a raggedy old doll, and she was standing there at the door looking down at her shoes. And I changed some clothes, washed off, grabbed a few things. We went out, and we stole that good man's pickup truck. And took it to the Greyhound bus station, and I bought me a ticket for me and her back to California. And I got me another bottle of wine, and I got on that bus, and I drank until I passed out. And we come to in Albuquerque, New Mexico the next morning. When I come to, my little girl, she was holding her stomach and rocking back and forth. And I said, what's the matter? She goes, Daddy, I'm so hungry. I'm so hungry. You haven't fed me. And I said, baby, as soon as we stop, I'm going to get you something to eat. And we pulled in this place, and I went to this little liquor store. I was so sick, man. I walked in there, and I got her a little sandwich, and I went over and I got me a bottle of wine. And I went over to pay for it, and I only had enough money for one or the other. And I had to put her sandwich back. I've done a lot of things in this world. I've never done anything that I don't share from the podium, but I've never done anything in my life that shamed me more than that moment. Shames me to tell you. I walked back on that bus, and my little girl looked at that brown paper bag. She'd seen a million of them. I couldn't even look at her. I just walked right to the back of the bus, and I sat down and just scooted right down where no one could see me, and I started sucking on that wine. And my little girl was sitting in that seat all by herself. And thank God there was an elderly black lady sitting there right across the aisle from her. That lady never said one word to me. She looked over at my little girl, and she said, honey, she goes, you know, my daughter made me this big lunch, and I can't eat all this, and I just hate to ride alone. Would you mind sitting with me? And God bless her wherever she is, because she took care of my little girl all the way back to California. She never said one word to me the whole time. And I got back to California, and I did what all heroes do at the end of the road. You know, I went to Mom's house. Told you about my mom. My mother thinks the sun rises and shines on my daughter. She had not heard from us in almost 3 years. She didn't know if we were dead or alive. And I knocked on her door, and she opened that door, and she looked at her granddaughter. She's on this dirty, raggedy dress. Face was dirty. She had been crying. She's holding on to this raggedy old doll and an old pillowcase. And she said, Grandma. My mother grabbed her up, man, and just loved on her, put her in the house. She turned around, she looked at me, and she gave me a look I've never seen her give another human being. She looked at me like she wanted to kill me, and she said, you know what? She goes, if you ever come near me or this child again, I'll kill you. Now get off my property and don't you ever come back here again. You know, and thank God my mama, she saved my daughter's life, you know, and I've always been grateful for that. The next 3 years, I don't know nothing about it. It's all hearsay. You know, I'm a wino. I drink Gallo port wine, red port, tawny port preferably. And I live in a bamboo patch just below a restaurant on the right on the Pacific Ocean. The septic tank that drains down into this bamboo patch from this restaurant, nobody goes in there because it smells real bad. And right across Pacific Coast Highway, there's a little biker bar, and right next to it's a 7-Eleven. And I panhandle in front of that 7-Eleven until I get enough money to get a bottle of wine. I go back down to my little hooch, and I drink. And when I run out of wine, I come back up there, and I start the whole thing over again. And if I can't get no money, I stand in front of that little biker bar, and I wait for someone to order a drink and go to the bathroom, and I run in that bar and drink their drink as fast as I can before someone beats the hell out of me. And that's the way I lived for a long, long time. I don't know a lot of things that happened there, man. I mean, I don't. I hear people in Alcoholics Anonymous talk about blackouts. I had whiteouts. I was in a blackout for 3 years. But every once in a while, I'd come to, you know, and be just like this. Everybody's looking at me. I'm going. And then everything would fade to black. And I come through somewhere else. I'm looking up, and all these people around me looking at me, you know, and it fades to black. I'm standing in front of the 7-Eleven. I'm so sick. I'm completely, physically, totally addicted to alcohol. I cannot not drink. I drink to live. I'm standing in front of there. I've gone into grand mal seizures many times because I couldn't get a drink. And I feel it coming on. It's early in the morning, and I got 67 cents, and a short dog cost 89. And I'm so sick, I can't even move. I can't even panhandle another penny. I'm standing there, and this car pulls up, and it was a big four-door sedan. And there was this dude in there. He had a suit on and short hair. You know, and he has this square little wife sitting there right next to him, and his square little kid sitting in the back. And I didn't know how they could live like that, but, you know. Who am I to judge? And that man got out of the car, and he walked right over to me, and he said, "Excuse me, sir," he said, "would this help?" And he gave me two $1 bills. And I damn near knocked him down, man, running into that liquor store. He got me, I had enough money to get a short dog and a quart. And I came back outside that liquor store, and I opened that bottle the minute I got outside that short dog, and I just put her straight down. And I just held my face against that glass until the shaking started to slow down, and that glass was cool on my face. And I opened my eyes, and I looked in the window there, and it was a reflection of that family sitting in that car. And they were all talking and looking at me, and I knew they were judging me and talking about me. And I turned around and flipped them off and cursed them. And I went back to my bush. I'm here to tell you that those people became very dear friends of mine. They were not members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm not here to talk about religion. It's got no business in Alcoholics Anonymous. Those people, it was on a Sunday morning, and those people were on the way to practice their faith and the worship of God of their understanding. And they weren't talking about me when they were looking at me. That family was praying for me. That man has passed on, but that family became very dear friends of mine after a period of time. And I'm down there, and I'm sucking on my bottle of wine. And out of nowhere comes this voice. I don't know if someone yelled it. I don't know if it was an hallucination. I don't know. But I know what I heard. And it said, "Maybe you ought to go to A&A. I've been to A&A. You know, and detoxes and nut houses and, you know, and we got a real active group of Alcoholics Anonymous there in Carlsbad, you know, and there's always some 90-day wonder going to go down there and save me, you know, and I'd con them out of some money and I'd listen to their spiel and I'd patiently try to explain to them that I was not an alcoholic. You know, I'm a drug addict. I just can't afford any drugs. I mean, we all know drug addicts are much classier than alcoholics, you know. You ever seen a coke freak that's shooting coke running around looking for that last flake at midnight on the floor? You know, classy bunch of guy people. And they laughed just like that, you know. They told me if I ever wanted, if I found myself drinking and I couldn't stop drinking and I wanted to stop drinking but couldn't, they said to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and you would love me till you could, I could love myself. This dude told me that. I stood up, I almost knocked him out, you know. I said, you ain't loving on me, big boy. I had one of those whiteouts. And what happened was, I came to at the back of this room, and all these people turned around, they were looking at me, and they all had short hair, and they were all nice and clean. I thought it was a PTA meeting. That was my first impression. And they're looking at me, and there's a guy at a podium up at the front, and he's staring at me. And I'm looking at him, and he says, are you looking for Alcoholics Anonymous? And I nodded my head, because, you know, you don't want to look dumb. You know, and he goes, would you like to introduce yourself? I've been drinking wine around the clock for about 3 years. I don't associate with anybody other than to try to get a quarter from you. And the winos don't drink with me. No one. I have no social life whatsoever. And I lost the ability to really talk, and especially if I got real nervous. And I'd have epiphanies to say, but when I opened my mouth, well, not much would come out. And they said, would you like to identify yourself? And then all these people looked at me, and I went, ah. The guy looked at me and said, smiled. He said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Have a seat. So I remember that part. Y'all told me you're going to love me till I could love myself. I remember that part. So I saw this pretty little gal, and I scooted right over next to her. She looked absolutely terrified. She ran for her sponsor immediately, you know. I got to explain a little bit, back up a little bit. See, I've been living in the same clothes for about 3 years. My hair came way down past my ass. My beard came down past my belly button, you know. I weighed about 110. A lot of things lived on me besides me. I'm sitting there, this fellow said, there's something crawling across your face. I said, leave it alone. It eats the fleas. You know, they tell me that I had a distinct odor. I had the most insane look they'd ever seen on a human being. And no one really wanted to have too much to do with me. They just kind of looked, they were all looking at me, you know, and I was looking at them, and they're looking at me. And they start talking, and they start talking about God. And I'm going, uh-oh. And then I saw him pass a basket. Uh-oh. And I said, listen to what this guy was talking about. And he was sharing stuff, man. You just don't tell other people. My God, man. You know, and I just, gee, I was so embarrassed for him. And, I go, this is the lamest thing I've ever seen in my life. Good God. I got to get out of here, man. I need a drink. And I'd stolen some money out of that basket when it went by, you know. And just not no more than I needed. And I had a couple of bucks in my pocket. I knew I could get me a quart of wine. I'm out of here, man. And there was this little gal. She kept looking at me from the minute I walked in that room. She kept smiling and grinning at me, you know, trying to catch my eye. I thought she had brain damage or something, you know. And this guy was talking, man, and he embarrassed me. And I said, oh, God, I got to get out of here. I ain't listening to this no more. And I stood up. And this little gal, she rose to her feet, and she cut that guy off. She said, excuse me, son. Please don't leave. She started talking. She said, they dropped me off here 27 years ago in Long Beach, California. And I didn't want to go in there, but the cops made me go in there. And I walked in that room, and I looked at all those nice folks. And I knew when they turned around and saw me and recognized what I was, they weren't going to want me around their men. She goes, I've been living on the streets of Los Angeles since I was 13 years old, and I've done everything a woman had to do to survive. And when I saw you folks, I felt dirty, and I wanted to leave. And I started to leave, but a woman grabbed hold of me and brought me in and said, honey, don't go nowhere. And got her a cup of coffee. She started talking about 27 years of continuous sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. Talked about a group of women that grabbed hold of her and took this street whore and turned her into a lady. Talked about the 12 steps that she took with her sponsor. She talked about becoming absolutely responsible for all of her actions, reactions, and inactions in Alcoholics Anonymous. Talked about 27 years of continuous sobriety. She walked all the way over across that room. These people didn't know what to make of me. And that little old gal, she grabbed me by the head and pulled my face down and kissed me right on the mouth. The bravest woman I've ever known in my life. And I'm trying to get away from her, man. You know, and she ain't letting go, you know. And she grabbed hold of my neck and she pulls my head down. She's squeezing on me. And she's whispering in my ear. She said, baby, she says, don't go nowhere. Please don't leave. We need you desperately. Please don't leave. Please, God, don't leave. People have been beating on me all my life. Ain't nobody ever made me cry about nothing, you know. That old lady said that to me. All of a sudden, my eyes started getting wet. My belly started rumbling. And pretty soon, I'm crying like a little schoolgirl right in front of the PTA, you know. And I started coming to A&A. And I love that part you read about this group today. Y'all lied to me right from the beginning. A whole bunch of you did. You told me this. You said, just don't drink and go to meetings. That might be great for a problem drinker. I'm an alcoholic. I am an alcoholic of the absolute hopeless variety. Alcohol is not my problem. Trust me. My problem is I have an acute allergic reaction to sobriety. In about 3 days, I can't imagine in God's name why you would want to feel that way voluntarily. You know? How do you go to sleep at night? How do you stop them? And I would go to meetings, and I would go to meetings, just speaker meetings, you know. And I would go, and I would go out to coffee with you, and I'd hang with you as long as you could hang with me. And then you'd go back to your little meaningless lives, and you'd leave me alone. And I'd go insane. I'd go absolutely insane. And I'd stay sober as long as I possibly could. Sometimes even 24 hours, you know. Sometimes I could go a whole day without drinking. And I'd get to that next meeting and you'd tell me the same thing. I said, don't leave before the miracle happens. They didn't tell me that I had to take the steps before the miracle was going to happen, you know. They just said, keep coming back. Don't leave before the miracle happens. Well, the miracle never happened. And I went to that meeting for over 6 years, drunk. Not too much. I get brief periods of sobriety, always followed by a still worse relapse. You know, I saw people come and they told me that I needed to get a sponsor right away. I asked what that was. It sounded like a parole officer to me. You know, I go, nah, man, I don't need that. And I'm doing fine. And I said, well, you got to take those steps. I looked at those steps. None of that stuff applied to me. I can see where it could have helped some of you. You know, first step, already gave it away. Said, I'm powerless. I've been carrying a gun since I was 14 years old. Believe me, I am not powerless. You know, says, my life's unmanageable. My greatest fear in life is mediocrity. Who in the hell wants to know what's going to happen next? How can you live that way? I like my life unmanageable, you know. I like leaning against the wind right over a cliff, you know. And I'm going to go back and it says, you know, that turn my life over to God. I cried out to your God many times. Your God never cut me no slack. He likes those people in the suburbs, people like me, man. I got nothing coming, neither does he. You know, I've been doing fine without God. So I went right back that I got this another one and said, what's this? He goes, well, you got to make a list of everything you've ever done and admit it to another human being. No, I haven't gone into it, nor am I. But I'm a career criminal. And I pride myself, and there's no paper traces of any of my activities. And now you want me to put everything down on paper and share it with the PTA. I'm not going to do that. If I tell you, I'll probably have to kill you, you know? And, man, I can't do that either, you know? And I got to this other thing about, you know, defects. I don't even know what that means. But the other one caught my eye. This is the one that scared me. I said, what exactly does an amend mean? And he goes, oh, that's easy. You just got to go find every person you've ever harmed and go make it right. Loopy, don't shoot. Give me a minute. I'm sorry I shot you and your brother and your dog and took all your stuff. But I'm in a spiritual way of living today, and I'm here to make things right with you. I can hardly wait to do that. And that was one of the easy ones, you know. There's places I can't go back to, all their kinfolk are dead. Now you want me to go find them all and go make it right. Yeah. What? An order? I couldn't do that. But you know, I'll tell you one thing. I wanted what some of you had. Not all of you. Not all of you today. But there was people in Alcoholics Anonymous who had something, and I couldn't put my finger on it. But I wanted it more than life itself. And it wasn't their women. It wasn't their money. It wasn't their stuff. It was the way I watched them. Because I always watch people, man. I've been watching people all my life. And I watched people who walked like they talked around here. I heard a lot of grand talk from people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I watched them walk outside of these rooms. They didn't impress me too much, you know. But I met people in Alcoholics Anonymous who were actually walking exactly like they were talking. And there was something different about them. I watched them walk through all kinds of horrible stuff, and nobody drank, nobody ran. And they walked with dignity, with no matter what happened in their life. And they kept reaching out. And there was a group of people. I came to that one meeting, Thursday night workshop in Carlsbad, California. I never missed it every Thursday night that I wasn't in jail, you know. I came in that meeting, tore up, drunk. I stole from them over and over and over. And I'd walk in that room all messy and dirty. And those members of Alcoholics, there's a group of people there that are still there today. And I'd walk in that room, they'd be talking to their friends, and they'd stop talking. They'd run to me, and they'd say, oh, Kip, thank God you made it. It's so good to see you. Welcome. Let me get you a cup of coffee, son. And they never judged me, and they didn't preach to me. All they did was welcome me. And I knew they cared. There was a whole bunch of people. They were too busy to talk to me. I don't see them anymore. You know, probably just a coincidence. I was just at Cliff Roach's 40th birthday party, and he's a member of that group. And there was over 500 people came to wish Cliff a happy birthday. And I looked around that room, and I saw all these old people that were welcoming me into the rooms a little over 26 years ago. And you know what? They're still there at the same meeting, and they're still doing the same thing. And, man, that was just such a nice feeling. You know, I come to the last, one of my last drunks. This is come to Christmas morning, 1984. One more time, butt naked, hog-tied. I was in a rubber room in county jail. Cops had beat me down. They busted my cheekbone open, and I was bleeding, and I'd been bleeding all night, and it blooded. My face was stuck to the mat, and I'm trying to peel my face. That's real hard to do when you're hogtied and your legs, you know. And I finally peeled my face off, and I looked up the little portholes, and these cops were all looking down at me laughing. And I knew Santa Claus wasn't coming. They let me out of there. They knew me by my first name there. They said, Kip, he says, you know, it's Christmas. Why don't you go on out of here? We'll see you later on. And they gave me my stuff. And I made a conscious decision that day that I wasn't going back to AA. You know, God, I wanted what y'all had. I wanted it so bad, but I knew I could never achieve it. I could not live without alcohol. Alcohol was the only thing that never lied. Alcohol was the only thing that took away the pain. Alcohol was the only thing the only thing that took away that loneliness. That alcoholic loneliness that I don't care. I don't care what your bottom is. I don't care if you come from Yale or jail. It don't matter. When we talk about that alcoholic loneliness, we know what it smells like, tastes like, and feels like better than any segment of society, I believe, in this world. Because through alcohol, we have cut ourselves off from all of humanity. And we want to be a part of, but don't get too close, you know. And I was the loneliest human being in the face of the earth. And I said, you know what, I'm going to go spend all my, I had $90, I don't know where it came from, but I went and spent every penny of it on Gallipport wine. This Marine had taken me in and let me live down the lower part of his little place, you know, and I went down my little hooch down there and I stored up my wine and I started drinking. And on January 6th of 1984, the worst thing that's ever happened to me happened. It talks about it in a vision for you very clearly. It says, there'll come a time when you cannot imagine life with alcohol or without it. And if you've been coming to AA for a long time and AA don't work for you, oh Lord, the day that liquor stops working for you, you are going to know loneliness such as few people can even comprehend. You're going to come to the jumping off spot and you're going to wish for the end. And I pulled out my gun that morning because my body was as physically drunk as a human being could possibly be. My mind was absolute crystal clear. And it didn't take away the pain no more. If anything, it amplified it. The loneliness, if it would have been a tangible thing, it would have eaten me alive that day. The thought of living was the most terrifying thought I've ever had in my life. And I pulled out my gun and I put it to my heart and I pulled the trigger and I blew my left lung and two ribs out. Knocked me all the way across the room. And I slid down this wall. I remember that, man. Blood was pumping out of my chest everywhere. And I said, thank God this is over with. Thank God this nightmare was over with. Let me out of here. You thought I died, didn't you? Yeah. Yeah, I know. Every once in a while I hear someone say, for me to drink is to die. Only if you're lucky. Only if you're lucky. There's an old guy in AA. I hated his guts. His name was Charlie Tuck. Said he'd been in AA so long that he only had one A in it when he got here. And I believed him. He was an old gangster from Chicago, and he came up dead in my face one day at a meeting when I was coming in and out, and he got right down in my face. He said, son, he says, I want to talk to you. I said, yeah? What do you want? He says, you think you're pretty tough, don't you, kid? I looked him right in the eye. I gave him my best jailhouse look, you know. I said, I'm tough enough, old man. Don't you ever doubt that. And I just gave him the evil eye, and he looked and gave me the evil eye right back, you know. And he stared at me, and he kind of grinned. He said, son, you're the scaredest son of a bitch in this room. I'll grant you, that might make you dangerous, but it sure don't make you tough. And he walked away laughing at me. I avoided that man like the plague. The time I'd go into an A&A meeting, I'd walk around looking at all the windows, make sure he wasn't in there, you know. Anyway, I'm dead, right? Charlie had the deepest, graveliest voice that God has ever given a human being. It was such a distinct voice. I mean, you could be in a crowd of 1,000 people and you could hear him. You know, and out of nowhere, I hear this voice, you know, and I'm floating in this blackness and I hear this voice and I'm going, no! And I open one eye, and there's Charlie Tuck at the foot of my bed. And he's got these two dumb newcomers looking at me. And I'm going, God, I've died. I've gone to hell. And this is the way it's going to be for eternity, this old fool preaching A&A. Charlie looked at me and he put his arm around these two young fellows. He said, fellas, pay attention to this fellow here. Get down there and get close to look at him. Don't be shy. And they got up there and they're looking at me and they're sniffing on me, you know, and they go back to Charlie, you know, and they're standing there and they're looking at me. Charlie says, I want you to pay attention to this fool. This is what happens to an alcoholic who refuses to take the steps. Come on, let's go. And they left. I felt cheap and used, you know. May 12, 1984, I came to the same way I've come to 1,000 times. My first conscious thought is to get something in my body as quick as I possibly can. That is always my very first conscious thought. And God gave me a moment. And this is where I'm here to tell you that I am God's favorite child. You might think you are, but I know I am. God gave me a vision that morning that I don't have the vocabulary to even explain it to you. But what I saw and felt with every emotion in my body, it was like watching a movie, and I watched and I remembered the day they put that little girl in my arms. And it was like it was happening. And I felt that incredible, overpowering love that I felt for that child. And I remembered the promises that I made her. And I meant it with every fiber of my being when I gave it. And I felt that love again. And it immediately switched to this other picture. This old man walking past this little girl in a raggedy old dress that was crying because she was hungry. And her father walked right by and he took her food money and bought a bottle of wine. First step is absolutely the most important step we ever take. There's nothing written. It says, to my innermost self. Not what you admit to your drug counselor, your sponsor, or anyone else. In here where you live, where no one else can see. What does that word mean? Alcoholic. What does it mean? Powerless over alcohol. And I knew. I knew with every fiber of my being. Protecting your child, nurturing your child is genetically engineered into a human being. You don't have any choice. Alcohol was the most powerful thing in this world. It took that away. I will steal the food out of my child's mouth for a drink. Alcohol, I'm not powerless over alcohol. Alcohol is my master. It tells me where I can live, where I can go, when I can go to bed, when I got to get up. And there ain't no room for anyone in this world that if you're going to get in the way of me and my drinking. Nothing comes before alcohol. Nothing. And I got scared because the next person said that no human power was ever going to fix me. And you people in Alcoholics Anonymous have been trying to fix me for years. And I've met a lot of young gals in Alcoholics Anonymous who tried to fix me. You should have listened to your sponsor. But then it got to the thing I've been dodging since I've been here. You know, it says, you know, but God could and would if he were sought. And thank God I'd been paying attention. And what I've been paying attention to is some of you people around here that walk like you talk. I watched you go through things, man. And I watched you talk and I listened to you. And you all talked about the same thing. You talked about this power that had come into your life. It did for you what you could not do for yourself. And I got down on my knees and I said this little prayer that ain't changed much from that day to this. I said, you know, I don't know who you are and I don't know what you are. From this point on, I will do absolutely anything if you put in front of me if I don't have to drink. And if you're not there, I'm screwed. You know, and I don't know how to tell you, but you know, something happened to me that I can't even explain in words. But I'll tell you this. I am a chronic, hope-to-die alcoholic. And right then and there, I knew with every fiber of my being that if I could hold on to that thought, I was not going to have to drink that day. I knew it with everything I had. So I went to Charlie's house, because where else am I going to go? You know? And I got to Charlie's house, and his wife had been a wonderful member of Al-Anon for over 40 years. And I knocked on her door, and we called her St. Edie. You know, and she opened that door, and she goes, oh, Kip, oh, you're Charlie's favorite. goes, why don't you go around the porch, you know, and he'll be out in just a minute, honey. And so I go out there, and here comes Charlie walking out, and he says, morning, Kip. He says, what can I do for you? I looked at him. I said, Charlie, I don't ever want to take another drink in my life. He goes, you've been saying that for quite a while. What's different? I said, I don't know. He stopped, and he looked at me. He just looked right deep into my soul. He had that kind of look, man. He just looked right through you. He says, Kip, he says, I got some good news, and I got some bad news. Bad news is this. People like you don't get sober. Period. People like you die in institutions. You die in the side of the road. They don't even write their name down. The good news is this. I've been around here for a while. And I see a teeny tiny little sparkle in your eye. And I know what that is. God has opened a window for you, son. And this is the way it's going to have to be for you one day at a time, every day of your life. That absolutely nobody, no one, nothing, no job, no woman, no child, no nothing in this world can ever become more important than doing what you must do to maintain your sobriety. And that is a lot more than just going to AA meetings. Do you understand that? I said, no, sir. He said, I'm going to teach you. And I said, okay. I said, what do I do? He said, follow me. It was on Mother's Day. And he lived right across from this park, and all these families were there having picnics with their mothers and families together. He walked right in the middle of this big old crowd of people partying, and he just dropped down on his knees. And I looked at him. I said, what are you doing? He says, we're going to pray. And I looked at him, and I said, in front of these people? He looked at me. He said, son, first of all, these people have been walking over, stepping over you for years, you know. Second of all, the only hope you got is that God is going to grant you some grace. If you're embarrassed to worship God already, don't waste my time or his. And he started to get up. I said, wait a minute. And I dropped down on my knees. And that old man took my hand, and we did the third step prayer together. I didn't know what it meant, but it sure felt nice. You know, he took me back over to his house. And Charlie was a taper. He'd been taping for years, and he loved Norm Alpie. And he took me back in this back room where he detoxed fellas, and they detoxed me with taro syrup, a little bit of whiskey, you know, and orange juice. You know, and 6 hours of reel-to-reel Norm Alpie over and over and over, you know. And the guys he sponsored would come in and sit with me, and they'd tell me their stories, you know. And they'd make me eat a little something. When I'd throw up, they would clean it up. And I couldn't figure out what their angle was. And after about 5 days, I'm starting to feel okay. And Charlie walks in that morning, and he looks at me. He goes, okay. He said, son, Alcoholics Anonymous is a program of action. Are you ready? I said, all right, Captain. I said, what do we do? He says, get in the car. I thought that was the first step for a long, long time. I didn't get sober at meetings. I didn't. I got sober sitting in the back seat of cars, listening to old timers talk to each other while they are going someplace to speak, or going down into different detoxes and jails and institutions and listening to these old timers talk, just listening to them, listening to that incredible wisdom and their sick jokes, you know. And they got me busy. And Charlie made me do stupid stuff, man. He made me get a job, you know. He said, you got to pay your bills when they come in. I told him, when I first got my first paycheck, I said, Charlie, they want all my money. He goes, no, they don't want one penny of your money. You send them any of your money, you'd screw up their books. They just want theirs. Oh, I get it. Made me start paying my bills. He made me to make a commitment to be at a meeting of alcoholics every single night. And the first thing he did was teach me what the word commitment means in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if some of you knew, let me tell you what that means. It means something different in here than it does out there. We asked you when you came in here, are you willing to go to any length? You told us you were. Okay. When you say, I commit to doing something here, there's only one excuse for not doing it. You died on the way there. Period. I don't know about y'all, but I ran out of excuses the day before I got here. I was not allowed any excuses for any of my behavior. I made a commitment to be at a meeting. He says, I want you at a meeting every single night. You get there early. You shake hands with every single person that walks in there. You ask them their name. You ask them how they're doing. You don't borrow any money from them. You don't borrow any cigarettes. You don't tell them nothing about you unless they ask. And then just in general terms. He says, someone asked for help in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, your hand better be the first one in the air. He said, it is not a right to be here. It's a privilege, especially for someone like you. And I'm coming up on 90 days. I said, I got 90 days. He goes, so what? What, 90 and 90? He goes, what is that supposed to mean? I don't know. There, I said, if you show me where it says that in the book, I'll believe it. I said, how long I got to go? He says, till you want a drink. When you want a drink, go ahead and leave. As long as you don't want a drink, stay here. And I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I carried 5 commitments a week for the next 8 years, and I never missed one night. And I am so grateful I had a sponsor that ran me like that. Because I'm going to tell you all something. I'm the sickest man you ever met. I'll guarantee it. The hardest thing about this whole deal, it ain't learning what's in that big blue book. It's been unlearning what I already knew. It's been, you know, they said you're going to get brainwashed. I said, we can only hope, you know. We can only hope we're going to brainwash you, you know. Because unlearning what I knew when I walked in these rooms is the hardest thing I've ever done. And it's been a long period of doing that. You know, things in my life started happening quick. He made me get a job. That's a really spiritual story. I didn't know how to do anything, you know. I can shoot good, you know. I can count money real fast. I can put 9 tons of dope from Zuwat and Nao to Cambridge, Massachusetts with no problem, but I've never filled out a job application, you know. And he made me get a job. I said, well, what do I do? He says, I don't know. Only God knows what you do. I said, what do I do? He said, well, get on your knees, tell God you learn a trade, and take whatever he's got for you, because that's what he wants you to do. I said, okay. And I got on my knees and said, I need a job. In fact, I need a career. And I'll take whatever you got. And I got up and I walked out. I lived right behind this little honky-tonk. And I walked out to the street and I stuck my thumb out. And this pickup truck rolled up and he rolled down the window and said, hey, you want a job? Scared me to death. I said, I don't have a car. He says, that's all right. He says, my shop's across the street. I said, what is it? He goes, it's painting. I said, I don't know how to paint. He says, I'll teach you. Okay. I go back, I call Charlie. I said, Charlie, I got a career. He said, what is it? I go, it's painting. He says, that's a good job for you. You don't have to think very much. He said, remember that talk about commitment we talked about? I said, yes. Okay, you're going to make a commitment to that man, to me, to the God of your understanding. You're going to go to work for that man. You're going to work for him for a minimum of 2 years. He said, you'll be the very first person to be there every day. You'll work every hour that he asks you to work. You'll do it gratefully. You will never, ever question anything. And you will do whatever he tells you to do as long as it's legal, moral, and ethical. You will never ask him what he's paying you. Whatever he pays you is more than you're worth. It covered every angle, man, you know. And I went to work. I didn't know it, but I was a painter, you know. I had a real natural talent for it. And I picked it up, and they taught me how to do it just like everything else. They said, be humble. And I'd walk up to these guys that knew what they were doing. I said, I ain't got a clue of what we're doing here. I said, but I'll do anything I can to make your job a little easier if you'll show me a few tricks, you know. And these guys took me under their wing, and I started learning things, and I started doing stuff, you know. And these guys are drunks, man. I mean, well, I don't know about Georgia. But that trade of painting, man, it was like going to work at detox on Monday, you know. And I take my big book to work every day, and I don't eat lunch with them because they're all drinking and getting high, you know. And I'm sitting over here reading my book, and one day this guy, Steve, says, hey, you give me a ride home? He says, you're in that A&A, aren't you? I said, why? I ain't going to cop to nothing, you know. And he says, well, he says, I heard about you. He said, and I recognize that book. He says, I used to be in A&A. But I got drunk so many times, it's just so embarrassing. I can't raise my hand, it's just too embarrassing. And I said, really, how long did you do that for? He said, oh man, almost 6 months. I laughed at him. I told him about almost 8 years of me doing it. And I said, you know what, I tell you what, Steve. Tuesday night, I have a hell of a time getting to a meeting. Why don't you come on over, and me and you will read that big book. I live right behind the 49er right here, little honky-tonk bar. Their back door is right next to my front door. I said, you know, you change your mind, you can go in and drink, man. You can stay at my house, you know. And if you get 30 days, you can sneak back into A and you won't have to raise your hand. Nobody will know. He went, oh, that sounds good, you know. That meeting, I'll tell you, has evolved and two of the largest men's meetings in my whole area. It's over 600 men are the most active groups and everywhere we go. Between those two groups, they pay 80% of all of central office, hospital and institution. We own H&I, you know. We are at every institution, especially every jail. You know, our members are either the hole in the wall or robber's roost, which is my home group. And that's, and just, God just put me where he could use me, man. I take no credit for that, you know. He just put me where he could use me. And where he could use me to do his work, he also taught me a trade where I could support myself. After 2 years, I got my contractor's license, you know. And I've never passed in. I'm only thing I certificate I've ever had was a drunk driving school, you know, and I still couldn't drive drunk very good, you know, and I passed that test. I got my contractor's license, you know. I got the state of California gave me my driver's license back, which is an hour talk all in itself, you know, and I came home, man, and I have married this wonderful woman. I've got custody of my children at 3 years sobriety. My life is wonderful, except I still have a drinking problem. And at 10 years sobriety, let me tell you, I got it going on. I got the big house, man. I got the boat. I got the new cars. I'm traveling around the world. I'm sponsoring San Diego, you know. I'm on every committee there is. I got everything going, man, and you know, and I got to go to Australia, and I came to Australia, and I stayed there for about a month. I just fell in love with it, and I came back home. You know, when I was 3 years sober, after I got my driver's license, I got a phone call one night, and it was a young lady, and she says, "Your name Kip?" I said, "Yeah." She goes, "You know Sandy?" And I said, "Well, man, a long time ago." She goes, "That's my mother, and you're my father. And I've been looking for you for a long time, and I want you to meet your grandchildren." And that little girl that I missed all those years, she came back into my life, man, and all. And she brought me three little grandkids. And I came in here with a lot of old ideas, nothing I'm proud of, man, but they were just part of me from where I come from, you know. And one of them was color. And I never thought and looked about it. I had no feelings one way or the other. Just don't go there, that's all. I went to go meet my granddaughter, my daughter and my grandchildren, and they got out of the car, and my grandchildren were black. And my little granddaughter walked up to me, man, she's got chocolate skin, and she's got blue eyes and my nose. She walked right up to me, man. She goes, "You ain't my grandpa." My heart exploded in my chest, you know, and God just washed all that nonsense right out of my heart, you know, and it was a wonderful thing. But, you know, I come back from Australia, and the first night I'm sitting in the morning, I'm looking at my beautiful house and my job, and man, I'm counting my blessing, thanking God for this miracle he's done in my life. And I read in the front page, and reading about a horrible story about some man who broke in this woman's house and raped her all night long in front of her children. And when he was done with her, he took a knife and he cut her to pieces. And it was my daughter. And I got over to the hospital, and I saw my daughter, and her face was absolutely destroyed. She'd lost her left arm and her breast. And I don't know about y'all, but, you know, I'm absolutely perfectly capable of first-degree murder. And I don't talk about nothing, man. I don't know about anger. I hate co-defendants, so I don't ever talk about nothing, you know. And I'm making plans, and I want vengeance, and I am absolutely insane, and I can't go to meetings, and I can't talk about it, and I can't cry, and I can't feel nothing. It's just ice cold in my heart. And I'm looking in that book, and I ain't looking for an answer. I'm looking for a loophole. And all it says in there, if you got a little resentment you can't get rid of, man, I've gone through that page by page, and it covers it real clearly. It says that is a dubious luxury of normal people. But I'm an alcoholic, and for me to harbor such feelings will cut me off from the sunlight of the spirit, and the insanity will return, and I will drink. My sponsor told me that nothing could become more important than me doing what I got to do to stay sober. And I look in that book, and all it says in there, if I got a resentment I can't get rid of, I got to get on my knees every single day and pray for that human being to have everything out of life I want. And the hardest thing I've ever done in my life since I landed on your planet was to do that. Well, I'm here to tell you something. It worked. And I ain't talking about forgiveness. I'm talking about insanity. Absolute cold-blooded insanity. It went away. And you know how I knew it went away? I started crying. I started talking. I let people come into my life and I cried. And thank God the life that you had given me, because I had the financial resources to take care of my daughter and my granddaughter when she needed my grandchildren, when they needed me the most in their life. You had produced a human being that was there for them, body and spirit. And I got through that, and I didn't have to drink, and I didn't have to hurt nobody. I didn't have to hurt me. Right after that, they told me I had cancer, and they're going to cut off my lower lip. I like my lip. Like it right where it's at. Been chewing all my life. And I told my sponsor, she said, go get another doctor's opinion. I went to another doctor. And finally, I met this great plastic surgeon, Dr. Asher, wonderful man. And he did this radical surgery on me. But he told me when he did it, he says, are you allergic to anything? And I said, anything that affects me from the neck up. He goes, what do you mean? I said, have you ever seen an active heroin addict before? And he goes, yeah. In a hospital. I said, no, in your living room. He goes, no. I said, you give me any of that dope and I'm moving in with you. I said, I'm going through an awful lot of absolute terrible emotional pain right now. And if you give me anything that gets between me and that pain, I'll never be able to stop. And I know that. And he goes, man, he says, your lips are nothing but nerves. You can't go through this surgery. I said, listen, you know what? I can handle physical pain. Trust me. I'm not too smart. You know, I burned up most of my brain cells on cheap liquor. You know, the one thing I know from the bottom of my heart and every fiber of my being, that no matter what you got to do to stay sober, it's easier to stay sober than to get sober again. I know that. And I'm going to tell you, I went through that surgery with none of their pain medication. I ain't here to tell you, a little bit of Novocaine when they first did it. And I did it with absolutely no dignity. I cried and sniveled like a little schoolgirl every single day. Ray, and for these guys, they know the kind of guys I sponsor. They don't even know what sympathy means. You know, they would come over and tell me jokes and try to get me to laugh, you know, and my whole face, where they cut a big chunk out, and then they put it all back together and sewed it up real tight all the way down that way, man. And it was real tight, and the stitches went all the way inside of my mouth, and they were like just like an antenna to the nerve, and they just delighted in watching me snivel, you know. And but you know what? They sat with me around the clock. Those guys never left my side. And I got through that, and I didn't have to take any of their stuff. And I ain't telling anyone else to do. You do whatever you want with your medication. My wife won't leave me if you get loaded, you know. I got through that, you know, and this woman I had married, I loved. Her name was Connie. Wonderful woman. Just absolutely wonderful woman. And we'd been married, and we had a good life. And I came home. I'd been really involved with my daughter and my grandchildren and the surgery and everything. And we hadn't been talking a lot. And I came home one day, and she was crying. I said, what's the matter? She goes, Kip, I can't do this no more. I'm going to drink. And I said, what are you talking about? She goes, I can't live this lie. I said, what are you talking about, Connie? She said, Kip, she goes, I'm a lesbian. And I'm in love with Chrissy, and I have to leave. Boy, I could have knocked me over with a feather. I said, you're what? You know? And she told me this. You know, I ain't got any tools for that. You know? You can shoot me, you can stab me, you can set me on fire, you can beat me with a club, but God, please don't tell me you don't need me no more. I ain't got no tools for that, you know? And so I react the only way I know how to react. I cursed her. I called her horrible names. I cursed her girlfriend. I stormed out of that house. She had brought me into the Catholic faith, and I'm not here to talk about my religion, but it's part of my story. You know, and a guy that had really impressed me with that faith, with a Catholic priest named Father Bill Wilson, just coincidence. And he was a sober member of Alcoholics for almost 28 years. And he became my godfather in that church. And I went down to his parish to go down and see him, you know, allegedly to get some counseling, in reality to rat her out to the church, you know. And I'm going down there and I'm... I'm sitting there and I'm telling Father Bill, I'm telling him the sad story, and he's looking at me and he's going, oh my, oh my, oh God. He had this deep Irish brogue, and he says, oh Lord. He says, oh Kip, you must feel like life is screwed, just square in the ass. I said, yeah, that's it, Father, that's exactly how I feel. He goes, yeah. I said, so what do you think? He goes, I think you make me sick. I go, what are you talking about? He says, you're always talking about that big book. You ever bothered to read it? Well, what are you talking about? He says, oh, man, why don't you start with maybe page 61? Well, how does that apply? Oh, you know, it doesn't apply to you. The guy that thought he could wrest satisfaction out of life if he did everything just right. You keep telling me what a wonderful father you've been, what a grand husband you've been, and you have done this for her, and you've done that for her, and now she has done this. You poor man. He says, you ever bother to read the next page at the bottom, the last paragraph on page 62? Here's the how and the why of it. First of all, you have to quit playing God. He goes, who in the hell gave you the right to stand in judgment of any of God's kids? She's not your property. She's your wife. She's been a good wife to you. Can you imagine the courage it took for her to come and face you? Can you imagine that? And she is a good member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You go give her whatever she wants. And you make amends for what you've said. And I went back to her and I apologized to her. And I said, okay, she goes, I guess you want a divorce. And she goes, yeah. And we split everything, and she took my boat. He said, give her anything she wants. And that's all she wanted. She wanted my boat, you know. Oh, I like that boat. She kept my last name. Her and that gal are married today. I don't understand it, but it ain't none of my business. You know, she didn't have to drink, neither did I. She tells everyone that I'm her brother, and I am her brother, you know. And I found out that a relationship can change in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, that our love was, our marriage was never based on sex. It was based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I loved her. And if that's what she needs to be healthy and free, that's what she needs to be. It's none of my business. You know, my business is my actions, my reactions to your actions, my inactions, not yours. And so I said to my sponsor, I said, so what do I do? He goes, you give it to her. And I did, you know, and I got through it. She didn't drink. I didn't drink. I got attacked by a dog right after that. And a dog almost tore my right arm off, and I couldn't work. And I ended up losing my home, and I lost my business. And I lost absolutely everything in the world materially that I had worked for. The last thing I had was my son, my little boy. The little boy that told me to pray that he died, you know. And I'll tell you something. At the age of 23 years old, that little boy graduated from high school. Because I learned how to be the father of a handicapped child through the members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was the kind of father to that little boy I dreamed about being the day he was born. He lived with me, he worked with me, and he was my best friend. And he got sick, and he died in my arms on October 4th. And that's when the promises came true. That's when the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous came through. It says that we will know serenity. See, I know what serenity is. You know, I've had... many moments of absolute pure serenity. It has nothing to do with watching a sunset with a beautiful girl with a pocket full of cash. Oh, that's nice. But serenity was watching the thing I loved the most in my life die. And hurting more than I knew it was humanly possible to hurt. But at exactly the same time, knowing without a shadow of a doubt in my heart of hearts that it wasn't personal. This was God's business, and God do not make mistakes. I got down on my knees, and I thank God for you people who taught me how to be a father. that gave me that life that I dreamed about with him. You know, I threw it away. And I got back and I went back to my home, and all the guys I sponsored were sitting at my house, you know, and I was just nuts. And Scotty was there. He knows Scotty real well. And there was a guy, I was sponsoring this new guy, and he says, "Man, this guy's been calling you all morning, all morning." I said, "Man, I got to go. I can't handle it, you know." He says, "Well, what do I do? He keeps calling." I said, "Oh, God, let me talk to him." So he called. I picked up the phone. I said, "Henry, look, my son just died in my arms about 20 minutes ago. Man, I ain't got nothing for you." He goes, "Gee, that's too bad, Kip, but this is really important." Started laughing, and I went, "You're right. You know, you're right. My primary purpose is to carry the message. Anytime anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of aid. And for that, I am responsible. No matter what's going on in my life, that's what my primary purpose is. My son did not need me anymore. This guy did. And he saved my life." The way it is today, I stayed away from women because I needed one. My sponsor, I told him I needed a woman in your life. He says, "You know what? It's impossible for an alcoholic to have a relationship if he needs one, because you can't have a relationship with a woman until you don't need a woman to validate you as a man. Stay away from him." One woman took advantage of me in a 2-year period. I'm weak and she was sick. You know, and you know, I hadn't gone out with any woman. I'd been going to school, and I got a call one day, and this gal, I told God, you know, that, you know, everything's fine, but I'd love to experience true love in my life sometime, but if that's cool, whatever. And I got this call, man, and this gal, and she said, "You know, she got drunk last night, got in a horrible wreck, she got massive brain damage, and what do you want me to do with your daughter?" I said, "My daughter? What are you talking about?" She goes, "You got a 3-month-old daughter." I said, "No." She goes, "Yeah." She goes, "I ain't raising no more kids. You want her, come and get her." And I went up there and I went to go get her. And I opened the door. She looked. She said, "You Kip?" I said, "Yeah." She gave me this bunch of paperwork. She gave me a diaper bag and a little baby in a bassinet. She said, "Good luck." And I looked at this little girl. She had my nose, my eyes. She looked at me and grinned, and I fell in love, you know. And that's my Natalie. Everyone said, "You got to get a blood test. Make sure that's your baby." I said, "No, no, no. God gave me this baby. I ain't giving it back no matter what." I don't need no blood test, you know. She needed a daddy, and I needed someone to love, you know, and it's been a perfect. She's 14 years old. She's the sunshine of my life. And I got to meet another lady later on when I didn't need no woman. I didn't need no woman in my life. My life was. I think you guys are the greatest thing since banana peels, but I don't need any of you, you know. I'm a whole human being without any woman. But I met a woman. That, you know, I'd known her for years. We've been on many things, and we started dating. You know, and I learned how to date without trying to get in a lady's pants, you know, just trying to get friends and get to know her as a human being. And I started feeling something for this lady, and she loved my daughter. And I fell in love with this woman, and we got married. Next month, we've been married for 13 years. And Scott knows my wife. My wife is a beautiful woman. She's my lover. She's my best friend on the face of this earth. She's my business partner. And 12 years ago, we went to a hospital, and I cut the cord on a little boy, and his name is Will. And Will's 12 years old now. I went to school, I got a really good education, and I became really good at what I do. And I started a business that has allowed me, I can retire anytime I want now. 1993, I declared bankruptcy, I had the clothes on my back. You guys taught me how to do things that I didn't know how to do in here. You taught me how to be a man. You taught me how to be a father. You taught me how to be an employer, an employee. You taught me how to be a member of a community. You taught me how to be responsible. You know, and I went to school and I started this business that's gone real, real well. You know, I work out of my house. I take my children to school in the morning. I homeschool my son. I'm on 2 different PTAs. They hate me. I'm not shy, you know. You know, I'm involved in so many different things in my community. I'm involved in Alcoholics Anonymous with every fiber of my being. I'm here to tell you this, that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, as written in the big book, and it doesn't need any help from anyone else, as written in the big book, will work for absolutely anybody, anywhere, under any circumstances. It doesn't matter what you've done, and it doesn't matter what you haven't done. It doesn't matter what's going on in your life. I don't care what's going on in your life. You don't ever, ever have to drink or run from nothing again. You can walk with the greatest dignity no matter what goes on in your life. And you don't have to hurt nobody. You don't have to hurt yourself ever again. You know, this program works every single time for just as long as you're willing to do it, not 1 minute beyond that. That's all I got for you. Thanks a lot.
Can we keep him? We got a dear friend of We Are Not a Glum Lot out in Douglasville, Mark. And Mark volunteered to make a gift, a momentum for Kip, and I'd like to give it to him. It's a pretty neat deal. It's a wood burning, and if you get a chance after the meeting, come by and take a look at it. And there's a card from our group.
Thank you very much.
But I've got a momentum that we're going to induct you into the We Are Not a Glum Lot group. And this is one of a 25-year coin.